Welcome back to Jazz for the Asking, Hour 2. Keith Parent back with you for the second hour of Jazz for the Asking. It's nice to have you with us. We're continuing our interview with American legendary singer Steve Lawrence.
She loves me, and to my amazement, I love it. Knowing that she loves me. She loves me, true she doesn't show it. How could she when she doesn't know it? Yesterday she loathed me, now today she likes me. And tomorrow, tomorrow, my teeth ache for the urge to touch her. I'm speechless, or I mustn't tell her. It's wrong now, but it won't be long now before my love discovers that she and I are lovers. Imagine how surprised she's bound to be. I want her, that's the thing that matters. And matters are improving daily. And tomorrow, tomorrow, I'm tingling, such delicious tingles. I'm trembling, what the heck does that mean? I'm freezing, that's because it's cold out. But still I'm incandescent, and like some adolescent, I'd like to scrawl on every wall I see. She loves me. She loves me. She loves me.
Just recently, somebody had sent me a video clip of you and Sammy Davis Jr. at the Academy Awards in 1979.
Oh, boy.
Doing a song called Not Nominated, which is a medley of songs that were never nominated for an Academy Award.
It was great. I must say, you know, to this day, we get occasional notes and emails and about it, because in that time period, when we put that medley together, every song was worthy of winning.
Mm-hmm.
They were all, you know, they had five great songs. You know, like It Had to Be You, I've Got You Under My Skin, You'd Be So Nice to Come Home To, and Change Partners and whatever else. Only one song could win. The other four great songs lost. So when I did an album one time with Billy May, and we called it Academy Award Losers. There were some of the greatest songs you ever heard. I don't know if you have that album, but if you don't, I'll send it to you. I'll get it to you.
You and Edie have also recorded together. When the two of you are working together in the studio, do you have, like, the husband and wife spats in the studio as well, going, and she's saying to you, Steve, no, I'm not doing this.
I think by the time we get to the studio, we've worked with the material, and I think we pretty much are set in what we're going to do. We've had the discussions, whether they were mild or heated. We had that while we were living with the material, or at home or wherever. But I mean, we've had look, hey, we're normal people. We've had husband and wife fights that were beauties, you know, I mean, like anybody else. So over those many years, you've had to have gone, had a couple of disagreements, a couple of fights. One of the best shows we did, a live show, we had a fight in the dressing room, a real husband and wife fight. And we just were foaming at the mouth at each other. And you just can't turn that off. And we were screaming at each other. And what do you mean you're the best? And the guy says, and now, ladies and gentlemen, here are the stars of our show. Steve Lawrence eating what? We walked out with such venom at looking at each other. And we were such, I said everything to her that any husband ever wanted to say to his wife. And Edie said everything that every wife wanted to say to her husband in between songs. We didn't let it end. We were just, it was like therapy. We were taking it out on this poor audience who came here to have a good time. And the more neurotic and heated we got, they thought it was part of the act. They were laughing like you can't believe. Keith, they thought it was, I swear to you, they thought this was written stuff and that Mel Brooks wrote it or something. I don't know. But and at the end of an hour, we were like washed, like, you know, like we got off the couch like at a psychiatrist. So at the end of an hour we did on stage, we were fine, and we left all our problems with that audience who thought it was part of the act. They had a terrific time. And then every once in a while, we would run into somebody and said, I was there in Chicago that night that you had that fight with Edie, and I remember what you said. It was incredible. Absolutely incredible. You can't turn that on and off at will. You know,
it was probably one of those moments that even if you had the best writers in the world, they probably never would have been able to create anyway.
Now, as a matter of fact, when we started to work together, we knew all the writers. You know, the guys who wrote on Steve Allen Show, and I even got to Neil Simon and Mel Brooks, who I knew, and Larry Gelbart. All these guys would say, "We want to do an act. Can you guys write for us?" So they came to see us and they said, "Hey, you guys do naturally. We can't write what the hell you guys do. You know, you guys are doing husband and wife lines back and forth. We can't write that stuff." You know, so Mel Brooks, of course, was the craziest one of them all. He says, "I'll tell you what you do. You and Edie come out on a motorcycle." And I says, "No, you're crazy." He says, "Of course. Why do you think I'm here?" Yeah. So they never really wrote anything for us, and our act evolved over a period of years. You know, and we managed to stuff that worked for us. We managed to recreate, change the words, but recreate it. And by letting it loose, we'd always find new things to talk about, new things to do. Somebody once said, "Who writes your act?" I said, "Nobody." I said, "Edie, how you feel?" She talks for an hour. You know.
when the two of you met, was it love at first sight, or was it something that evolved when you were doing the television show?
Well, she often has said it was love at first sight for her. And me, it has always taken me a little while to recognize a great thing. But no, I did care. There was sparks early on, and we went together for 4 or 5 years before we married, and so we, you know, it was quite the experience. And I always run into people who said, "You know, I watched you two kids when you were young on the Tonight Show. I always knew you were going to marry that girl." So I would always say, "Well, why don't you tell me? You could have saved me a lot of time and a lot of money." But we kind of felt something. There was something there when we met, and I knew when I was in Brooklyn and she was in the Bronx, so I knew when I was driving her home, I knew I cared for her. That's a long drive.
I mean, not just in Hollywood, but even in New York, especially in the field of entertainment. I mean, this is something which is extremely rare.
I think today it's rare to have a friend for that long. I mean, it really is, but I think we're blessed on a lot of different levels. Edie and I, aside from a love that we share, and we're great friends, she's my best critic and I'm her best critic. We understand each other inside out. Mm-hmm. We both have a great understanding for what it is we do. Because we both do the same thing. I mean, I don't have to come home. And she says, "Well, how was your day at the office?" Because she was there too, you know. So I don't have to explain the other side of my life to her, because she's both sides of my life, you know. And she is my best audience. God, she laughs at everything I do.
Heaven, I'm in heaven, and my heart beats so that I can hardly speak, and I seem to find the happiness I seek when we're out together dancing cheek to cheek. Heaven, I'm in heaven, and the cares that hung around me through the week seem to vanish like a gambler's lucky streak when we're out together dancing cheek to cheek. Oh, I'd love to climb a mountain and to reach the highest peak, but it doesn't thrill me half as much as dancing cheek to cheek. Oh, I'd love to go out fishing in a river or a creek, but I don't enjoy it half as much as dancing cheek to cheek. Dance with me, I want my arms about you. The charm about you will carry me through to heaven. I'm in heaven, and my heart beats so that I can hardly speak, and I seem to find the happiness I seek when we're out together dancing cheek to cheek. Speak, and I seem to find the happiness I seek when we're out together dancing. We're out together dancing cheek to cheek.
Cheek to Cheek, Steve Lawrence, featuring arrangements and orchestra by Billy May. If you've tuned in, you're listening to Jazz for the Asking from PCJ Radio, this week featuring the music from the American Songbook from a man who has made the American Songbook his career, Steve Lawrence. Steve has been friends with many people in the music industry, many of them legends, including American singer Frank Sinatra. In 2003, Steve Lawrence went into the studio to record an album called Steve Lawrence Sings Sinatra, a musical tribute to the man and his music. One track from the album that is absolutely fantastic is the Sinatra classic, My Kind of Town.
My kind of town, Chicago is. My kind of town, Chicago is. My kind of people too, people who just smile at you. And each time I Chicago is, it's calling me home. Chicago is one town that'll never ever let you down. It's my kind of town. Every
It's my kind of town. Chicago is my kind of razzmatazz. And it has all that jazz. And each time I leave, Chicago is, it's tugging my sleeve. Chicago is the Wrigley Building. Chicago is the Sox and Cubbies. Chicago is one town that'll never ever let you down. It's my kind of town. Chicago, 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 Chicago. Yeah, Chicago.
My Kind of Town, Steve Lawrence. We now continue with our conversation with Steve.
You know, when the two of you would record albums individually, how honest were you with each other? I mean, there must have been times where she would look at you after you released an album saying, Steve, why did you do this? And you would look at her saying, what is this? Has that ever happened already?
those are exactly the words, Keith. I mean, if I was at a record, before we started, getting actively involved in producing our own records, I said, where did you find that piece of junk? Who found that for you? Said, well, this and that. And if it was an arranger other than Don Coster or Nick Burrito or Billy May or Nelson Riddle or Billy Byers or Alan Ferguson, guys that we worked with who were extraordinarily gifted, the company found an arranger and said, where the hell did you find this guy? So there were a lot of things that we both looked at each other askance. And how did you, hey, look, we all make mistakes. And like I said earlier, there's a lot of them we'd like to swallow and just take them back.
Mm-hmm. Now, you worked with Don Costa for many, many years. Is he almost associated with the Steve and Edie duo as much as Steve and Edie themselves? Would you say that?
Yes.
Yes.
Don Costa was the other piece of our troika. He was an extension of both of us, and such a huge contributor to the success of our musical careers on records, and even things that he wrote for us in person to do, musical arrangements. He was a great friend, and he possessed genius. I mean, here's a guy that this was an instinctive. I mentioned before about songwriters who were bright, educated, and knew the language and how to put it together. And then there was the instinct guy. Don was all music from head to toe, all instinct. And people would look at him and say, how does he hear this? He was not schooled and trained like those guys who graduated Juilliard or whatever the school was. He heard this in his head, and these guys, it's a gift. If all these guys were living in the 18th and 17th century, they would have been the classical composers of their day.
Mm-hmm.
They would have been Brahms, Beethoven, and Mozart. These guys like Coster and Riddle and Billy May and Purito, all these guys. They would have been the Brahms and Beethoven and Schumann and Chopin, and it's incredible what they heard. And they would look at an empty score pad and they could hear what they were writing in their heads. They were writing for like four trumpets and four trombones and four French horns and violins and violas and cellos. They heard it in their head. What a gift, my God, it's incredible. And I admire them, the good ones, so much so. There's not enough I can say about the great contribution that they've made in our careers musically, and the friendship which we had, great friendships. And unfortunately, these guys are just they're not making them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
there's a couple of people that are still around. My son David, by the way, is a composer, and he wrote the music for High School Musical 1, 2, and 3. I think you heard about that. You must have done those. Have you heard those?
Yes, I have. Yes, they were also here in Taiwan. The show was here in Taiwan.
Yeah, so he had great success with those, and he's written like about music on 4 television shows, and he wrote American Pie 1 and 2. Mm-hmm. So he's doing great, and but I mean, as a general rule, I don't think that the young people writing today. The technology is such that they're writing on computers. My son went to the Manus Conservatory of Music, so he knows how to write on a score pad like conductors used to write on, orchestrators, and write that as a big yellow pad, and there are a lot of lines on it, and each line represents a different instrument, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think most of the young kids today, their frame of reference, and you know, it's like I'm really not quite sure where it's going, because the technology changes every 6 months or something. You know, like pretty soon you'll have a computer the size of your wristwatch, and you'll be able to write on that too, I guess. I don't know. Like Dick Tracy years ago.
But do you also think at the same time, because there has been so many changes within the music industry. I mean, at one time, if you take, let's say, for example, a record label like Blue Note, that was run by two German immigrants to the United States who recorded music that they liked. And, you know, it was just pretty much the same with a lot of, even some of the major labels. You didn't see the same corporate influence as, let's say, you do today. I mean, back then it was pretty much the, you know, the producers and the record heads were saying, oh, you know what? I like this song. Let's get so-and-so to come along and sing it. Whereas today, it seems to be run by accountants and lawyers who think, well, how much money can we make from this?
It's. I think you're exactly right in your dissection of what you were talking about. But years ago, it used to be show business. Now it's the business of show.
Mm-hmm.
I think what has happened, even guys who love good music, who are not recording it, I'm talking about from the business end of things, they won't go into a studio with a great orchestra, a great vocalist, one who they held in great regard, and support them, because there's just so long they can do that without the sales being there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like they'll say, look, as much as I love you, I just can't keep losing money on this, otherwise I got to close I got to close the doors.
Mm-hmm.
So and I understand the business end of it, but I think companies that are making a lot of money should subsidize some things, and they really owe something to that business. And I think the only way to make a contribution back to it in gratitude for doing well is that to do some things that'll be around long after you'll be gone.
You know, in the last number of years, we've seen some singers come along that are quite young. I mean, I can think of, let's say, you know, Harry Connick Jr. or Diana Krall, or even, you know, more recently in the last few years, Michael Bublé, who've come along and are singing the American Songbook. When you look at this new generation of singers and the fact that they are being very successful with it commercially, do you think that this may in some way, you know, over the next while, you know, influence the large corporations that are running it and say, you know what, there's still money to be made with the American Songbook and this style of music?
I would hope so. I couldn't agree with you more. And I'm astonished that like Diana Krall and Harry Connick Jr., Michael Bublé, that they made it as big as they did in this world of music that we're living in now. So it seems that there is an audience out there, and they can be reached, but I think they probably want to be reached by the younger people that they can relate to on the calendar.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I understand that as well, you know, but the point is, I think on a record, you don't know how old that person is or who it is. So I think that we're missing a lot of wonderful artists that are not recording today. You know, when you stop to think that if those people that we grew up singing their praises, and you know, Frank Sinatra, Ella Fitzgerald, Perry Como, Buddy Clark, Dick Haymes, Sarah Vaughan. These people couldn't get a record contract today for love of money.
Mm-hmm. But yet,
and it is a shame. It is a shame, but it's the truth.
But yet, what is interesting is that their material is still being released today, and it's still being sold. I mean, Ella Fitzgerald and Frank Sinatra, their catalogs are being released. Yeah,
their catalogs are being sold, and people are going to Amazon and picking it up. Yeah, and they're repackaging them and boxing them, and they digitalize them, and you know, the technology today that they try to make them sound even, you know, brighter, like they were more recently recorded. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there is a market out there, and but it's a narrower market than it's ever been. You know, everything is so it's pop, it's pop rock, it's pop rock jacked, it's pop rock gen. There's country pop and country rock, country pop. You know, everything's got like you become, there's so many pigeonholes up there that I don't know what some the alternative rock. What's alternative about it? I mean, you either like it or not. So I don't know what if I were coming up today, I would probably have to become a plumber or something other than, because I don't know where the hell I would fit in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, fortunately, I came along at a good time in the world of music, when that was still being appreciated. And it's still, I mean, Edie and I individually, collectively sell, we have a website out there, it's Stephen Edie, it's StephenEdie.com, and we get so many requests for our material. And over the years, Edie and I have owned all our masters for the most part now. So, you know, if anybody out there wants to hear Stephen Edie music, just let them go to Stephen Edie at StephenEdie.com. And we'd be happy to, you know, just go to the website, take a look at it. Edie put that together. I don't even know how to turn the computer on, but she created the website. It's beautiful, and it's got so many of our records out there, and some biographies and things like that. She did a hell of a job.
But at
so
the same,
at
the same time, you're still performing. I mean, do you still get as much enjoyment out of performing now as you did 30 years ago?
Yeah, I just got back. As a matter of fact, last week from back east, I was back east in New York State, working up at a casino up in Verona and up in Rochester, Syracuse. Then I came down to Long Island, a theater in around 3,000 seats. The place, if I tell you, it was like a reunion. It was like old home week, and well, of course, there was a lot of people in particular in Westbury, Long Island. A lot of friends of mine I went to school with, and relatives and family and friends. It was a thrill. It really was. It was a great shot in the arm for me. I really loved it.
You know, just yesterday there was a song of that you and Edie recorded that I was listening to, which actually happens to be one of my favorite songs that you've done. It's a song in Hebrew called Bashana Haba.
Lashana Haba'a.
Haba'a, yeah.
It's in an album called The World of Stephen Edie.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you have that album. If you don't, Edie and I actually went in and we did... Mike Kerb, that was on MGM originally. We own that now. But Mike Kerb on MGM, he came, he said, you know, I think it'd be a good idea. There's a lot of hit songs in different parts of the world. I think the two of you should do it. So he got the big songs from like Japan and Greece and Italy and France and Spain and Portugal and Germany and all over the world. And he got somebody from Berlitz from each language to be in the studio with us and work with us and make sure that our pronunciation and enunciation was proper.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a terrific album. I'll send a copy to you if you let me know where to send it.
But I wanted to ask you, I mean, about that song and about
that
album.
If you want, get in touch with Judy on the email and just tell her we spoke and this is what you take a look at that and tell me what you don't have and we'll send it to you.
Well, what I have actually is a number of singles and some LPs that used to belong to my mom, which are mint condition. She took very good care of them.
Okay.
And You know, this album is quite amazing because you sing in different languages. Before, for example, let's say you recorded this song in Hebrew. I mean, this leads me to the question, because you are Jewish. I mean, at home when you were growing up in New York, did you learn Hebrew? Did you go to Hebrew school?
Yes, I did. And my dad is, as I said, he was a cantor. So I was brought up in a very Orthodox home. Mm-hmm. And I started to make the slight departure from that after I was bar mitzvahed, which is when age 13, 14. When I was about 14, 15 years old, I knew there was another world out there that I wanted to be part of. And my parents were very supportive of my decision. And but I'm thankful for the upbringing that I had. It gave me a set of values that I treasure to this day, and I instilled that into my family, and it was just wonderful. But if you get in touch with Judy on email, she'll send you whatever you need on CDs or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Steve, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to talk to us.
You're very welcome, and I can't tell you how much I enjoyed chatting with you. And one of these days, if you're here, or I don't know if I'll ever get to Taiwan, but if I do, I will look you up and seek you out and find you.
Somebody loves you, it's no good unless she loves you. All the way. Happy to be near you when you need someone to cheer you. All the way. Taller than the tallest tree is, that's how it's gotta feel. Deeper than the deep blue sea is, that's how deep it goes if it's real. When somebody needs you, it's no good unless she needs you. All the way. Through the good or lean years, and for all the in-between years, come what may. Where the road will lead us, only a fool would say. But if you let me love you, it's for sure I'm gonna love you. A fool would say.
you let me love you, it's for sure I'm gonna love you all the way, all the way.
All the way. Steve Lawrence. If you wish to find out more information about Steve Lawrence and his better half, Edie Gourmet, you can find a link to their website at the Jazz for the Asking website. Just go to www.pcjmedia.com and click on Jazz for the Asking. If you wish to contact us, our email address is pcjmedia@gmail.com. That's pcjmedia@gmail.com. We now go to a request that came to us from Richard Lowe in Singapore. He wants to hear something from Thelonious Monk, and he left it up to me to decide which one. Well, Richard, the track that I've chosen for you is called Well, You Needn't, here on Jazz for the Asking. Thank you. Well, you needn't. Thelonious Monk on piano, ending this edition of Jazz for the Asking. Once again, if you wish to contact us, our email address is pcjmedia@gmail.com. I also invite you to visit our website, www.pcjmedia.com, and click on Jazz for the Asking. We close this program with a singer that we get many requests for. Her name is Nina Simone. She is also known as the High Priestess of Soul. Here's Nina Simone from the album Sings the Blues with Do I Move You? Until next time, so long and take care.
Do I move you? Are you willing? Do I groove you? Is it thrilling? Do I soothe you? Tell the truth now. Do I move you? That pleases me. Are you ready for this action? Does it give you satisfaction? Pleases me. When I touch you, do you quiver?